This is Up for Sunday. I'm Rachel Martin, and today we are thinking about people under siege. We're bringing you the second part of The Black Gate, a Uyghur family's story. It's about a Uyghur Muslim man and his struggle to find his wife and children after they were detained by Chinese authorities. For years, the Chinese government has been arresting and imprisoning Uyghurs and other Muslim groups in Xinjiang. The detentions have been described by the U.S. government as genocide and by the U.N. as possibly constituting crimes against humanity. If you haven't listened to the first part, we recommend starting there. Today, Emily Fang and Abduwali Ayoub continue the story of Abdulatif Kuchar, a man desperate to find and bring his family home.
When we last left off, Abdulatif Kuchar, a husband and father, had been deported from China's Xinjiang region. He's had to leave behind his two young children, Aisu Mutfala and his wife Maryam. They hoped Chinese authorities would eventually give them back their passports so they could reunite. But in the meantime, they stayed connected by video chatting.
We would just talk about our daily lives, like what we had for breakfast and such. But later, even these calls were banned by community officials. They set specific times for when we were allowed to call each other. But we were told that they could see and listen to what we were talking about, so Maryam and I talked less and less.
Then, late one night in 2017, one of their nightly chats gets interrupted when Chinese authorities break into the Kuchar's apartment and arrest Maryam. 3 months later, the family members taking care of the Kuchar children are arrested too, Abdulatif says, and the kids disappear. They aren't the only ones in this situation. In Xinjiang, so many adults are taken away during this period that many children have no one left to care for them. The Chinese government acknowledges a boom in boarding schools in Xinjiang, and my own reporting suggests that many children whose parents were detained were sent to these schools. As for Abdulatif, he can only watch this nightmare unfold from afar. He's stuck in Turkey and has no idea what's happened to Aisu and Lufla. Friends and relatives in Xinjiang won't pick up the phone, or they tell him, "Don't call us ever again." Everyone is terrified. Abdulatif's wife, Maryam, is a Chinese national, but his children, they are Turkish citizens. So he does the only thing he can from Turkey. He starts lobbying Turkish ministers, demanding they help him get his kids back.
I couldn't sleep. Every day I had tears in my eyes. I nearly lost my voice because I was lobbying parliamentarians, ministers, mayors all the time. I kept searching for officials to meet, and whenever I met them, I would give them all the documents I had about my family.
As NPR's China correspondent, I started hearing more and more reports of Uyghur parents who had managed to leave China when the detentions began, but lost their children. One of these parents is Kalbanor. Kalbanor says she left her children behind in Xinjiang in 2016 and went to Turkey to give birth to her seventh child because authorities were cracking down on women violating China's birth restrictions. And while she was away, one by one, the adults in her family in China were detained. And then her children disappeared too.
My sister was able to tell me that my husband had been sentenced to at least 10 years in prison. I have not been able to talk to my family since after that conversation with my sister. They won't answer the phone.
They won't answer the phone, she thinks, either because they could get arrested for talking to people abroad, or they're already in prison too. So Kalbanor and other Uyghur parents in Turkey started forming Facebook and WhatsApp groups to communicate, and together they desperately scoured Chinese social media, hoping they might catch glimpses of their loved ones in state propaganda videos. In late December 2018, Kalbanor sees a TikTok video they found.
It was a random video, and when it began to play, of course I recognized her immediately. It was my daughter, Aisha. The video shows a lot of children in uniforms, girls wearing one color, boys in another. They're sitting around a table with drinking cups, and they're learning Chinese. They're learning Chinese words for ears and eyes and so on. In the background, I can see a room with beds, so it's like a dormitory.
Kelbanur sees her little girl, Aisha, with her head shaved. She's dressed in a uniform, so it looks like she's in Chinese school with other Uyghur children. It's a terrifying hint of what their children might be going through. For Abdulatif Kuchar, this kind of scenario is his worst nightmare. The idea that his children, Lutfullah and Aisu, might be in state schools without family and love. A place where they might be trained to reject their Uyghur identity. And here's where Abdulatif's story diverges from that of Kalbanur's and so many others that I've heard in my 5 years reporting on Xinjiang. After nearly 2 years pleading publicly for the return of his family, he actually hears back from the Chinese government. Abdulatif's brother, Abdurachip, remembers this moment.
He got a message from the Turkish Foreign Affairs Ministry. They told him, "We have received information about your bid to get your children back. You and your family are smearing the government. But if you want your kids back, apply for a visa to return to China."
Abdulatif was scared after this phone call. For 2 years since he was deported, China had forbidden him to return. Now they are telling him to come back. Was it a trap? It was impossible to know. Abdulatif says the Chinese government also had very specific conditions under which he could return.
The Turkish government met with the Chinese embassy to negotiate and help me get a visa to China. The Turkish diplomats said that after you go to China, you have to follow China's plans. You can't live in your own house because they will arrange accommodation for you and you have to report back to the Chinese embassy once you've returned to Turkey.
Of course, Abdulatif cannot guarantee his own safety if he returns to Xinjiang. And of course, he says, yes, I'll go. Anything for his family. So in November 2019, 2 years after his wife Maryam was arrested, Abdulatif gets on a plane and flies to China. The following is Abdulatif's account of how events unfolded. We confirm dates of travel, but the rest is from his memory. Abdulatif lands in Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, and is home with Maryam for more than 2 decades. He immediately feels something is wrong. First, there's the security presence. He's not allowed to live in his own apartment, which has been empty since Maryam's arrest. Instead, he's driven by police straight from the airport to a special hotel.
The police reserved 3 rooms in the hotel. Their doors were all kept open. And my room was in between their rooms. When I went out, 5 or 6 police followed me in 2 patrol cars.
Abdurachip would later tell me that his brother was especially shaken by the behavior of those he'd been close to.
Even in Urumqi, when he tried to call some of his friends, the ones who did pick up would say they'd call him back, but then never picked up their phones again. When he saw people he knew, they turned their backs and went another way. Everyone was afraid.
So day after day, Abdulatif waits in a local community office where Uyghurs come in and out, registering their identity papers. He keeps asking, "When do I get to see my children?" And he starts to panic. Maybe they've tricked him into coming to China.
They lied to me every day. They kept telling me, "Not today, tomorrow." But then 10 days had gone by, and they still hadn't let me see the children. I couldn't take it anymore, so I told them directly, "If you don't let me meet them, I'm going back to Turkey."
Abdulatif continues to go to the community center day after day. Then, one cold and snowy December morning, he's told the reunification is finally happening.
Officials tell me that the kids are on their way now. I go outside to wait for the car. Then, a police car drives into the yard.
Abdulatif hears knocking at the car window.
I heard shouting from the car. Then I saw them.
There in the police car are his children, Lutfullah and Aisu.
They ran to me just like a bullet from a gun. It was the hardest moment in my life. I can hardly describe it. I can only remember that I held them. Then I lost consciousness. I don't know what happened to me. It was like my heart just stopped beating.
He actually faints from emotion. And when he comes to,
I found myself on the muddy ground. There was someone feeling my forehead. The kids were on top of me. Then someone pulled me up and took our picture.
Abdullatif realizes there's a state photographer following them who is furiously snapping away, so Chinese propagandists can use this moment later in state media. He also starts to notice Aisu and Lutfullah don't seem to understand the Uyghur he's speaking to them.
They spoke Chinese to me, and when they spoke to each other, they used Chinese 100% of the time. I couldn't understand at all. I told them to speak Uyghur to me.
They can't. They seem to have forgotten their native language, especially Lutfullah.
He spoke Chinese just like a bird singing.
So Abdullatif uses a kind of pidgin Chinese, the few phrases he knows, mixed with Uyghur words to talk to his kids.
I didn't think of it as a language barrier. We could understand each other simply by looking at each other. They looked at me with smiles. I smiled at them, kissed them, held them. I could not find the words to describe how happy I was.
Abdullatif's Chinese handlers tell him he can bring the kids back to Turkey. They're foreign citizens and China doesn't want them. This is the reason Abdullatif's story is different from most Uyghurs, the reason he could get his kids back. But there's one last thing to do, and that's to find Maryam. He's told she's being kept in a women's prison in the city of Kucha, so he flies to Kucha with the kids under heavy surveillance. Abdullatif says his hotel was surrounded by about 100 soldiers and 50 or 60 police officers.
They started ordering me to take out all my documents, checking my suitcase, my passport, and marriage certificate. I asked them, "Who are you? And why are you treating me like this?" They said, "Shut up and don't ask anything." A Han Chinese person told me to get in his car and said to me, "I am the one who will take you around, but you can't ask my name and you can't ask me who I work for. In fact, you can't ask any questions." And that's how I traveled.
The officers tell Abdullatif that he and the kids have gotten special permission to visit Maryam in Kucha's central hospital. Abdullatif says he was told she'd be moved there from the women's prison as a concession to Turkish diplomats who'd negotiated the visit. I should mention that we reached out to the Turkish foreign ministry, but they declined to be interviewed for this story. China's foreign ministry and the Xinjiang government didn't respond to multiple requests for comment. To get into the hospital, Aisu, Lutfullah, and Abdullatif undergo a thorough security check and are told how to behave.
Our minders gave us 30 minutes of instruction, and the inspection was very strict. Even the children's hair was checked.
And they're told, do not hug Maryam too tightly or cry when you see her.
When we got into the room, the kids ran into their mother's arms. She was sitting on the bed, but she could not get down. She must have wanted to run to us and hold us, but no, she could only just sit on the bed.
Abdullatif is shocked at her physical state. She's lost so much weight, she doesn't seem to be able to stand.
I told my wife to be hopeful. God will help us. But she held my hand and said, "Don't say God in front of me."
Maryam also seems to have lost all her hair. She tries to comfort Aisu and Lutfullah, telling them she's just receiving medical treatment. And despite the explicit instructions he's been given, Abdullatif starts to cry.
I grabbed my wife's hand. There was no flesh at all, and I saw the shadow of handcuffs on her hand. When we had to leave, I hugged my wife. I lifted her directly off the bed. When I put her down, her legs were so weak that she could not stand. I didn't want to let her go, but the staff started yelling at me.
What are you doing? Why don't you obey us? That's when I said to myself, what's the point of living like this? But my children grabbed my hand. I looked at them and I thought, I have to raise these two children. I have to live for the children.
In total, they get about 15 minutes with Maryam and then they're ushered out. That's when Abdulatif says he's told he can't take her back to Turkey. She's been sentenced to 20 years in prison for colluding with terrorist organizations. The alleged proof was that Maryam had taken a picture with Turkish President Recep Erdogan some years earlier during one of his state visits to China. Turkey has complicated relations with China, and the picture was used as evidence Maryam had suspicious ties to communities of separatist Uyghurs abroad. What haunts Abdulatif to this day is how Maryam must be suffering in Xinjiang. From what the family knows, she is still in a Xinjiang women's prison, where malnutrition, overcrowding, and sexual abuse have been reported.
I've experienced unbelievably difficult days. I do not know whether it's a test from God or what.
After their visit with Maryam, Abdulatif and the children leave China for good. They return to Istanbul. Late last year, Abdulweli and I were able to interview the family in their Istanbul home. Abdulatif, Aysu, and Lutfullah live there with Abdulatif's second wife, Nuriman. It's unusual, but not unheard of in Uyghur culture to have more than one wife. It's been more than 2 years since the kids got out of Xinjiang. In some ways, the kids seem like themselves again. They're quiet and polite, and they love playing chess with their father. Nuriman says they have come a long way since first arriving in Turkey.
They were like a living corpse in total shock. They didn't even know how to talk and what to say or where they had come from. Somehow, we felt like we were in a dream. I didn't know what to say. My children were just looking around in shock.
Abdulatif immediately brought Lutfullah and Aysu to a doctor to check for signs of physical or sexual abuse.
The doctor was very careful, checking everything from their hair to their toenails. He was worried the children's internal organs had been poisoned, about whether they had taken any medicine and so on.
Nuriman, their stepmother, says they were found to be very malnourished. She started filling them up on Uyghur dishes.
Both of them are particularly weak in the body and lack nutrition.
Nuriman's really stepped in as their surrogate mother, and throughout her interview with her, she kept calling Aysu and Lutfullah her children. Over time, Abdulatif has been able to piece together what happened to Aysu and Lutfullah while they'd been separated. He learned through conversations with his children that in February 2018, a few months after Maryam's arrest, authorities took Aysu, who was 6 at the time, and Lutfullah, who was 4, and put them in separate boarding schools, specifically for Uyghur children without parents. These schools are among at least 1,300 boarding schools set up across the Xinjiang region, according to Education Ministry documents. Xinjiang local governments have been scrubbing their websites of all references to the boarding schools. But an official education report from 2017, which is the year before the Qajar children were sent to the schools, says nearly 500,000 children had already been enrolled by the start of that year. And until Aysu and Lutfullah, no one I'd ever met had been able to get their children out. Abdulatif had done the nearly impossible. He'd found his children and brought them back home. I first heard about the Qajars through Abdulweli Ayub, the language teacher who'd been arrested for starting a Uyghur kindergarten. After spending 15 months in prison, Abdulweli was eventually released. He now lives in Norway with his family, and he helped report this story with me.
It's really heartbreaking because of my niece is in Chinese boarding school, is in Urumqi. Yeah, like it's personal for me because those kids are just like my niece.
Abdulweli went to visit the Qajars in Istanbul and translated when I spoke to them. During one conversation, Abdulwali and Abdullatif together asked Aysu about the physical punishment she faced. This is the first time a Uyghur child who went through one of these Chinese state schools is sharing their account publicly.
Sen ağladın mı?
Çok az.
Aysu is saying here the big sisters at the school beat us. They would not let us cry. The teachers wouldn't punish us. But when we went back to our dormitory, the big sisters would physically punish us there, behind the closed door. There was nothing we could say.
The big sisters and big brothers, older Uyghur students tasked with monitoring the younger students. Both Aysu and Lutfula remember one punishment in particular. They call it the motorcycle.
O cezayı ablalar veriyor, değil mi?
When Abdulwali asks them to show him, both Aysu and Lutfula squat and hold their arms straight out. Holding the motorcycle position for long periods of time is exhausting and painful. Abdulwali says he had to do the same punishment when he was in prison.
That Lutfula, he told me that they punished him like that motorcycle. That way, I hold him and I cried because of I had experienced that when I was in detention. And he told me that they asked him to stand against the wall, like hands up, your hands like this. And it also the common practice in jail. And another third one, he told me that they asked you to stand 1 foot. Like this. It's also common practice in the jail. I had never imagined those kids punished like adults. Yeah. Because they are kids. How could that be possible?
While in the boarding school, Aysu told her father she eventually lost all her hair. Both kids had their heads shaved when Abdulatif picked them up.
Aysu says the dormitory monitors would beat her and pull her hair enough so that all her hair fell out.
Each day in the boarding school, the kids say their routine was the same. Get up, make their bed military style, eat together, then take Chinese class. After classes...
Aysu says after class, she would go back to the dormitory, watch some television, then do homework. They weren't allowed to talk while doing homework, which they had to finish before watching television. I asked her what she did after she was done with all that. She said she just would stare at the ceiling in the days if she couldn't sleep.
They were also punished if they spoke Uyghur to each other. Only Chinese was allowed. And each day, they went to class where they learned patriotic Chinese songs. Here's Abdulatif remembering one song his children kept singing when they first arrived in Turkey. Songs praising grandfather Xi Jinping and father Wang Junzhen. The latter is the former security chief of Xinjiang, who has been sanctioned by numerous governments, including the U.S. government, for human rights abuses. Aysu and Lutfula refuse to sing this song now. After the kids are settled in Istanbul, Abdulatif enrolls them in school. It is a tough transition. Remember, they'd forgotten both their native Turkish and Uyghur languages. Abdulwali and I had the chance to speak to one of Lutfula's teachers. He didn't want to be named in the interview because discussing China's actions in Xinjiang is sensitive, even in Turkey.
When I compare with other children, Lutfullah is very calm, but he cannot speak. He cannot express himself. I did not have this problem with other children. They too were Uyghurs, children from Xinjiang. They had no such problem in their ability to understand and express themselves.
And the teacher notices that Lutfula is extremely fearful. He asks for permission to do everything.
When Lutfula needs to go to the toilet, we let him go himself whenever he wants because the toilet is quite low. But Lafula does not go himself. I think he is unable to ask me for permission. His stepmother came to school and told us, "Teacher, can you ask him if he needs to go to the bathroom? He can't tell you himself."
When he visited the Kuchars, Abdulali also had a hard time getting Lutfullah to express himself.
He always have a feeling of negotiating between himself. Is it right or wrong? Is it right or wrong? I have this feeling too. I still have this feeling. I always, in hesitation, I always negotiate myself. I should do it or not? I should do it or not? I should do it. Because of its, if you frequently punished, and you have this feeling, you are not decisive.
Months after returning to Turkey, the kids both continued to bear the mental scars of that experience.
They would talk in their sleep and gnash their teeth. My daughter would jump around while sleeping, just like a cat. She would keep saying, "No, no," in her sleep. My son also could not sleep well. So I would sit all night by his side, watching him. It took about 3 to 4 months before they stopped talking in their sleep.
Aysu and Lutfullah later tell their father they were sometimes kept in solitary confinement in the dark. Even now, they're afraid of sleeping without the lights on. Abdulali was shaken when he heard this. He was also punished in this way and experiences the same fear.
And night, I'm afraid of voiceless. I'm afraid of living alone. And he is the same. He cannot even go from one room to another room alone if he is alone at home. Like those trauma reminded me that I saw from his eyes different version of me.
Today, both Aysu and Lutfullah are still in the middle of a long recovery process. They're physically healthy now, they're fluent in Turkish, and they say they've forgotten all their Chinese. They're going to art therapy, and after school, they attend Uyghur language classes. For Abdulatif, his children are his biggest hope now. He wants them to grow up happy and go to university. That was his and Maryam's dream for them, an opportunity he was denied growing up in China. Aysu has already said she wants to become a doctor. But Abdulatif feels like he's running out of time. As unlikely as it seems, he still hopes that one day they can all be reunited with Maryam. But last year, he was diagnosed with cancer.
The illness is bothering me, but the hope is supporting me too. I am praying for Allah. I am taking every measure. If my illness gets better, I am not going to stop. If Maryam is alive, I am going to keep up my activism. If I never see Maryam again, I will become a different Abdulatif.
Just before police broke into Maryam's apartment, she sent Abdulatif a video. She was going to the market with Lutfullah. You can hear him chattering excitedly.
I cried every time I watched the video, but I couldn't allow my mother to see me, so I cried behind closed doors, or I'd walk to a park near our house. But at the park, I'd see other kids playing, and that reminded me of my own kids. I would ask myself, what was their crime?
That question hangs in the air for anyone who has studied or reported on Xinjiang. It floats unsaid among Uyghurs looking for their lost families, and in the minds of people who've seen loved ones imprisoned or hurt. What exactly was their crime?
You're listening to the song, My Dear Son, When Will You Return? It's by Uyghur singer and activist Rahima Mahmoud. This story was reported by Emily Fang with Abdulali Ayoub. Phoebe Wang produced the episode. Our editor is Jenny Schmidt. Justine Yan is our assistant producer. Fact-checking by Naomi Sharp with help from William Chase. Mastering by Robert Rodriguez. Abdouweli Ayoub provided help with translation and interpretation. Additional translation by Qasim Abdurrahim Kashgar. Mehmet Jun Juma, Mukaddas Lee Hale, Sabina Gusbeth, and Qasim Abdurrahim Kashgar did our voiceovers. Music by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Shirley Henry, Ariana Garab Lee, Gregory Warner, Duri Buscarin, Vanessa Castillo, and the Kuchar family for sharing their story. Anya Grunman leads our team. The supervising producer of Up First Sunday is Liana Simstrom. Up First will be back tomorrow with all the news you need to start your week. Meanwhile, have a great rest of your weekend.